Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Billy Joel, so much wisdom from Billy Joel. All right, this is a show about masks. I should say, I mean, obviously I'm not wearing a mask right now doing a radio show and all, but I do own now a pandemic mask sewed for me by a friend who is, I think not by coincidence, a Korean-American woman from Korea originally. And it's a beautiful mask that, I sound like Trump, it's a beautiful mask. It's the best mask, but it's got kind of a Spider-Man pattern on it and stuff like that. So I like it. And it's me, you know. So we're going to talk about masks, about the semiotics and demographics and politics of masks. We're excited to begin with Ryan Lizza, chief Washington correspondent for Politico, a senior political analyst at CNN. He is writing a book about 2020 with Olivia Nuzzi. So already they lead the league in Z's. And he has been writing about masks, the politics of masks for Politico. And he joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Very excited to have you. So, you know, it really has become the case now, certainly in a place, I'm sitting here in Connecticut, if I'm in a store or some other place like that, and everybody's wearing masks, the help is wearing masks, most of the customers are wearing masks, and there's one guy there who's shopping who's not wearing a mask, you could pretty well tell how he voted in the 2016 election. I think that's sort of the case that you're making, and there are some demographics that back that up, right? Yeah, not hearing Ryan back.
I'm having a little bit trouble hearing you. I apologize.
Oh, okay.
Are you hearing me?
I am hearing you. Yes. This is the world we live in right now. So yeah, I was saying.
Apologize.
Did you hear my question?
You'll laugh because my quarantine radio office right now is the car in front of my house because as you can imagine, sometimes during the day, if you've got too many people there, it can be a little crazy and there's not actually a quiet spot to do a radio interview. So that may explain our technical difficulties.
Yeah. So did you hear my question?
I heard most of the wind up there, but just, I heard what you were saying. And then I think I just missed the final actual question.
Well, the question would be, I mean, I was sort of kind of heuristically saying, if you see the one guy in the store without a mask probably voted for Trump in the 2016 election. I mean, that's just my best guess or my supposition based on gut. But there actually are some numbers to back this up and some reasons to think that might be the case. So maybe give us a few of those.
Oh man, I'm so sorry. The reasons for what exactly?
Oh, so why you? The reasons for why you would be able to make a political guess about somebody who's not wearing a mask.
Ah, gotcha. Sorry about that. Well, it has become, as the pandemic has sort of been put through the filter of our polarized politics. I think the mask has become the symbol of the resistance to some of the policies. So lack of wearing a mask among a certain coterie of people on the right is a sign that maybe you're a little skeptical of the efforts to contain the coronavirus. Maybe you believe that the state actually doesn't have the right to enforce such a thing, right? And so it's become, you know, what should just be a simple health guidance from health officials has become a much more politicized symbol, where you know, in the neighborhood I live in DC, you know, you certainly get some strange looks made, and certainly you'd probably be thrown out of a store if you weren't wearing a mask, where in other places, as we've seen some of the protests that have popped up, not wearing a mask is a sign that you're skeptical of this whole thing and a person of the right. And I think that all of those, symbolism has become more prevalent as the pandemic has moved along here. There are other things that have become politicized, but the mask is sort of the ultimate symbol.
Right, because it's on your face and people can see it. So, Ryan, we're going to try to sharpen up your connection a little bit. If you see your phone ring, answer it. We'll see what we can do here. And so while that's happening, let me just say that there actually is some polling on this now. Gallup has now polled on demographic subgroups wearing masks and their comfort level with wearing masks. Overall, U.S. adults, 36 to 32 are in favor of wearing masks or are wearing masks either always or sometimes, I guess. Okay, so and as I look at the bar graphs here from Gallup, it's kind of interesting how well they track onto voting patterns in the 2016 election. So the more education a person has, the more likely that person is either to sometimes or always being wearing a mask these days. So if you have postgraduate education, it's 40% always in public, 35% sometimes in public. That's a very high number. Roughly the same number for college graduates. So you could pretty easily map those numbers onto the numbers from the 2016 election, and you'd have have kind of a similar thing. People who were likely to vote for Trump in the 2016 election kind of fit the demographic profile. I would add that similarly, women are more likely to sometimes or always wear a mask in public, more so than men. In fact, it's a pretty big spread in Gallup. 44% of women always, only 29% of men always. And then it evens up a little bit in the sometimes wear a mask in public category. So Ryan, welcome back. I think you might be on a different connection now.
Yeah, I think it's better now. I apologize for that.
No problem. As long as you can hear me, that's good. Kat, if you can boost him up a little bit. There are some reasons for this. We could start with the big orange reason that sits at the top of all this, which is that not only has the guidance from the federal government about masks kind of flip-flopped a time or two. I mean, even at the level of the CDC, they haven't always been clear about it. So there's reasons why people might have ambivalence about wearing a mask. But the president of the United States does not wear a mask, says he's not going to wear a mask. That can't be insignificant.
Absolutely. I think he sets the tone, and when a new subject enters our politics in a really kind of wide way, the way that the pandemic has, and voters don't necessarily use or can't necessarily use their pre-existing takes on other issues or ideology to sort of settle on what they should think about it, you know, it's well established in political science literature that they look to political leaders or commentators that they trust, political commentators that they trust on their side to sort of, know what to think about it. And, you know, there's interesting, you know, I don't think it had to have gone this way, right? I think just as easily Trump could have been a hawk on wearing a mask and obsessed with kind of his germaphobe side, and much more obsessed with the CDC leadership, and could have, he could have been the person of the mask, right? I don't think that's, there's nothing about Trump that made this obvious that this is the thing he would seize on. And so just as with Republican voters during the Ebola crisis that Obama was dealing with, they were the most fearful of Ebola and sort of traditional kind of conservative view of, you know, something threatening the country, and we needed to put, you know, do everything we can to defeat it, right? So they could have gone in that direction with this pandemic, and they didn't. And the reason they didn't, just go back to where we started with your question, is Trump. Trump sent the signal that he had some skepticism about this and has notably refused to be seen in public with a mask. I will say we don't have to wear masks at all times. I mean, we shouldn't be silly about mask wearing. You know, there are circumstances where wearing a mask is obviously not necessary. So I thought, for instance, when, you know, I was at a press conference with Trump the other day in the Rose Garden, it was the first day that everyone at the White House, all the staffers, were wearing masks. The journalists were for the first time wearing masks as they asked questions. That was new. Now, Trump was not wearing a mask. Should he have been? Well, he's up at a podium, distance from, you know, at least 6 feet from the closest person. I'm not so sure it's necessary that he wears a mask in that circumstance. And I think there, you know, we can be a little silly about overemphasizing the importance of the mask. But there's no doubt that he has signaled skepticism to its to the benefits of it.
Right. Although if we wanted to be extreme about the mask, from an epidemiological standpoint, you can make a tremendous argument in countries where they've gotten 80% or plus compliance on masks. They win. They stop the virus. I think Taiwan might be the most prominent example of this. Now, there could be a post hoc, proctor hoc fallacy here. It could also be that a country that can get 80% of its populations to wear masks in public all the time is probably also able to get a lot of other public health messaging and compliance out too. But masks kind of do, in Asia, indicate a high success rate for stopping the virus. But it's not just
Absolutely.
Trump anyway. Let me just play this for you, Ryan. It's not just Trump anyway. It's obviously the kind of echo chamber of media that speaks for Trump and speaks to Trump when he's watching TV, which he does a lot. Kat, let's hear Laura Ingraham.
Well, by the way, they'll say this whole mask thing is settled science, just like they do with climate change. Of course, it's not. And they know it. Our own experts have gone from masks aren't necessary to masks are essential. You have to wear them when you go jogging in just a few weeks' time.
Right. So it's not just coming from Trump. It's coming from kind of a network of sources that include President Trump and his defenders.
Yeah. And there's this, you know, there's this effort. And there is, as you pointed out, there was conflicting guidance about the masks. So people, it's understandable that people might be a little confused. I remember early in the pandemic when it was the cool thing on social media to criticize people for wearing masks. And that was coming from a lot of smart liberals I know, because they were saying that, you know, it doesn't do anything. So there was, you know, this is all new to all of us. We haven't experienced this. So there's, you know, it takes some time to understand what's sound and what isn't. What I think is unusual, especially in that clip you just played, is there's just a built-in bias towards skepticism about all of it from some of the conservative commentators. And there's this, you know, not so much an interest in, all right, let's get the full story on mask wearing. It's much more of a, let's find any piece of evidence to support my new political position that masks are a great infringement on my right. That's where polarization comes into an issue like this. So suddenly you have a new political issue where people don't actually have a pre-existing ideological opinion on it, and suddenly one forms, and everything gets filtered, you know, through that lens. It's almost like we've almost had a laboratory experiment about how polarization, you know, kind of warps our politics with this pandemic.
Yeah, and I would say some of it's predictable. I mean, the particularly the strong Trump constituency, I'm not saying all conservatives, I'm not saying all Republicans, but the core Trump constituency does include kind of a rejection of expertise, kind of a rejection of science, kind of a sense that they don't want people with graduate degrees in fields they can't even name or pronounce telling them what to do in their daily life. But I think one of the arguments you're making, too, is it kicks in also in a very visceral level. And so when you can start completing some of these basic visceral statements about American life, real men, ... So real men don't wear masks, and die, yuppie scum, you there in your mask. It starts to become a class thing. It starts to become a somewhat educational attainment-based thing. And to a certain degree, and once again, the demographics point to this, it may be kind of a gender thing. Maybe there are guys who really do think that real men don't wear masks.
Yeah, you know, there's a good column by in the Times by, oh gosh, I'm forgetting his name right now.
Frank Bruni, maybe?
Wasn't Frank, it was something that was just posted yesterday by, I'm so sorry that I'm forgetting this, but it actually went into a great deal of political science about, specifically about gender and the differences between men and women on this issue. And if I remember the name by the end of the our time together, I'll throw it out there, because it really is worth reading and had a great deal of survey data and political science about this divide. And he, you know, Tom Etzel is the name of the columnist. And one point that Tom made that I do think is interesting and sort of piggybacks on what I was saying before is that this was the phenomenon of how Republicans decided what to think about this issue was 100% driven by the leader of the party. It was Trump's view on this that sort of won the day, right? You know, you could just have, Trump could have just as easily been pro-mask, and you, I think almost certainly would have seen the right being, you know, wearing MAGA masks and, you know, re-elect Trump 2020 masks. And there are some of those out there. But I think the phenomenon to me that is just fascinating here is how much when a new issue like this crops up, the power of the president to completely define his party's view of this. That's really unusual. I don't think Obama necessarily had that ability, but Trump really does.
Right. Although I think there are some questions
tomorrow.
Yeah, I think there's questions about how he validates certain things. And once again, semiotics kicks in. He would probably be more likely to have like Chuck Norris and Tom Selleck standing up there in MAGA masks than to have Anthony Fauci and a few other microbiologists. I mean, I think that his base kind of hears that whistle clearer.
But what if Republicans had, what if the main response from Republicans and conservatives had been what it was when Ebola was a threat, where the kind of like, you know, threat instinct of that sometimes defines the right, if that had been the overriding thing, like, oh, my God, there is this terrible virus that could kill us all. We've got to hit this with everything we can. And that was the view when Ebola, when there was that, when Ebola was threatening the United States. And that didn't happen. And I think the difference here is, you know, what Trump's view was. Now, maybe you could argue he took his cues from some other conservative leaders. But I guess my point is it wasn't 100% certain at the start of this whether the view was going to be, oh, those pointy-headed liberals with their science and their health expertise, we don't have to listen to them. Or it was going to be, oh, my God, this is a national security threat, you know, just like terrorism or any other national security threat. Conservatives are going to be the uber hawks on that, on this issue. And if anyone's not listening, you know, to what the Trump administration is putting out, you know, they're idiots. That to me is the interesting part of like how polarized our politics are and how influential Trump himself is to sort of define like what strain of conservatism he's going to pull from and push when a new issue like this comes along.
All right. So, Ryan, Lizza, great to talk to you in your car, on the phone, on Zoom. It doesn't matter. Chief Washington correspondent for Politico, writing a book in 2020, about 2020, with Olivia Nuzzi, coming to a bookstore near you when bookstores actually are open again. We'll take a break. God willing. We're going to stay with this kind of idea of semiotics, and particularly the semiotics of fashion. And who better to do that with than Pulitzer Prize winning Washington Post critic Robin Given. Put on your mask. It might help our prognosis.
Put on your mask. Don't stop before.
So this is fun and exciting. I've been a big fan of Robin Given for a long time, even before the Pulitzer. Fashion critic for the Washington Post. She's the author of The Battle of Versailles, the night American fashion stumbled into the spotlight and made history. She's been writing a lot about masks, because if you're a fashion critic in April and May of 2020, what else are you going to write about? You're going to write about masks. So first of all, Robin Given, welcome to our show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, you know, just to kind of continue with the conversation from the first segment, masks have semiotics. They have symbolic meaning. And you know, Ryan Lizza was talking about the political division, but it's even more complicated, like, about that at the level of fashion. And one thing that you are suggesting, I think, is that at least on the fashion front, the battle is over and masks have won. They're going to be around for a while. But say more about that.
Yeah, well, when I was writing about it, I had the great luck of speaking to a religion professor, Liz Bukar, who, you know, sort of encapsulated a lot of the thinking or a lot of the questioning about masks. And she essentially said that, you know, if we are wearing a mask because we are afraid, every time we see someone else in a mask, it's going to churn up fear. But if we're wearing a mask out of consideration for our community and out of generosity to try and prevent others from being sick, then when we see a mask, our response is going to be, oh, that person is being considerate of me. So I thought that was a really interesting way of sort of grappling with a lot of the angst that people have about wearing something that for most of them is very unfamiliar.
Right. Another word besides consideration that came up in another of your pieces, I think, is the word humility. And there is a way in which the mask does say, I don't think I'm so important that I don't have to wear a mask. I'm going to follow these guidelines. I'm going to do what I can to make us safe in a communal sense. So there's a little bit of visually casting a little bit of yourself aside. You're covering half of your face, and you're doing it in a way where the underlying message, I think, is one of humility. But maybe you'd like to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're really casting yourself as one of many, as part of a community and part of a community effort, as opposed to when you're not wearing a mask and you're setting yourself apart and above and separate from those around you. And I mean, I think also when you are wearing a mask, it says that you are willing to consider the needs of other people. And that does require a certain amount of humility because, you know, as we're very much beginning to learn, a mask worn for any significant amount of time is uncomfortable. And as the weather gets warmer, it's more uncomfortable to wear them outside because they can be hot and they can make you sweaty and it's more challenging to breathe in them. So all of those things suggest that the decision to wear one really does require a kind of humbling.
And significantly, I mean, I just happened by chance to be in Japan in 2009 during the so-called swine flu pandemic. And in Asian countries, the adaptation to masks goes much faster. Taiwan, this time around, has done this did this incredible ramping up of getting enough masks ready, and now is doing kind of mask diplomacy, where they give huge numbers of masks to other countries. But there's a way in which there's a little bit of a east-west divide on this. People in Asia are, I think, way more comfortable with this idea and maybe even fits in a little bit more with their philosophy of what? Personal space and maybe humility.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why the wearing of a mask is so, here in the States, is so bound up in these ideas of individuality and what it means to be American and patriotism and all those things. Because, you know, there is this element of stereotyping and racism that we've seen directed at Asian Americans. There's this idea that America is this country of bold, strong individualism, and how dare someone tell me how to behave or how to dress or, you know, what I should wear. I think all those things get woven together and have, in some cases, meant that people have equated wearing a mask as somehow anti-American.
There's you did one of your pieces about the recent Senate hearing with the three leading public health experts in the federal government. And so for the first time, we got to see some senators showing up either with or without masks. You know, you and I think we saw different things in Tim Kaine, and I think you probably got it right. It's his kerchief, this black and red kerchief that was hiked up onto his nose. To me, it looked very Zapatista and kind of young Daniel Ortega, maybe. But you saw it correctly, I think, which is if, in fact, we're going to get a certain kind of American to get down with masks, we're going to have to invoke certain kinds of specific icons, like maybe cowboys or exciting Jesse James type bank robbers. You saw maybe a little bit of that in Kaine?
I saw a little bit of the Wild West in there. I saw a little bit of, sort of 60s protest in there. But I also saw this idea that, you know, yeah, he's wearing a face covering, but it also had this real message that, you know, this is a makeshift face covering, right? You know, he's not fully investing in a wardrobe of masks because he is convinced, you know, this is just temporary, so we can make do. And I think that is a message that for a lot of people is very reassuring.
There is a way in which all kinds of things get racialized. And, you know, as you have suggested and I've suggested, first of all, you know, Asian people are much more likely to be comfortable with masks and mask culture. The main mask, my number one main mask that I have right now is shared for me by a Korean woman who's a friend of mine. And obviously, Asian people, as you say, are being targeted for discrimination right now. I suppose an Asian person wearing a mask may have like sort of double inciting qualities for a certain kind of hooligan out there. But you've also written about masks and black men in particular, right? There's just a way in which maybe this is going to be read slightly differently.
Yeah, I mean, there have been cases where, you know, black men have talked about, you know, being uncomfortable walking into public spaces wearing a mask because, you know, they have been associated, obviously, you know, with criminals. And African American men have, you know, had their personhood policed. And this, I think, only adds to that, only adds to their risk and concern. And, you know, there is a long history of policing face coverings, whether it's, you know, with African-American men, whether it's with Asian Americans, whether it's with, you know, women, Muslim women who wear face coverings for religious or traditional reasons. There's this sense that a face covering creates, it, as they say in academia, you know, it others a person, and it makes them somehow seem like they're not one of us. And anything that does that to a group that's already, to some degree, marginalized, I think is creates a heightened danger.
So as this crisis broke out and, you know, most of us back in February, weren't actually keeping a lot of N95 masks or any other kind of masks in our house. It wasn't part of our lives at all, and there weren't enough of them. And the fact that the cloth masks need to be stitched, they often are these three-layer cloth masks. And so you have to ask yourself, who's good at stitching? Who might have a lot of, I don't know, fabric sitting around right now? So maybe you could just say a little bit about how the fashion industry, haute couture in particular, rose to this challenge.
The fashion industry has moved faster than it's ever moved before. It started out stitching up masks for first responders, and then it very quickly started stitching them up for, you know, civilians. And those masks have gone from basic, you know, fabric that was left over to all the way to designs that are brocade and velvet and embroidered and sparkly. I mean, they're offering up an entire wardrobe of masks for every possible situation.
Right. And so there's, you know, there's been sort of two currents that I detect in this, mostly based on my reading of Robin Given. But one of them is, you know, a general and genuine public spiritedness. You wrote about the designer Soriano. But in general, this kind of sense, well, yeah, we'll help. We'll pitch in. We can sew. We've got fabric. I mean, so there's that piece of it. And maybe you can say a little bit about that in just a second. And then there's another part of it that looks a little bit more to me like, to use the overused Rahm Emanuel line, never let a crisis go to waste. I mean, Disney is putting out 4 packs of masks with Disney characters on it. I mean, there's a little of both, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I mean, there's the charitable aspect of it, which I think is coming from a very good place, with designers creating them and donating them to hospitals and to people who need them, but you know, don't have access to them. And then there's this whole other element of people who are making them and selling them. But, you know, we're still in a place where no one has really sort of stepped beyond what has been deemed acceptable and done sort of really overpriced masks. Most of them are the cost of materials and labor. A lot of them are, you know, buy one, we'll donate one. And I honestly think that if the industry, if the fashion industry can make them more appealing and make people less hesitant to wear them, then the fashion industry is doing a good thing.
So as we get ready to wrap up here, first of all, I have had a ambition to get you on the show for a really long time. So I'm really happy that you're here. But so now let's imagine that I see you on the red carpet, still during the mask era. Who are you wearing, Robin Given?
Well, I joke that when I was working on the story and I went deep down the rabbit hole of masks, I emerged having ordered one with silver sparkles on it. So
Not going to mention any designers, but you've got a look you're going for anyway.
Exactly.
All right. Well, if you ever run into me, I'll be the guy with the Spider-Man pattern on his mask.
Sounds good.
All right. Robin Given for The Washington Post. We are so thrilled to have you, and I hope you'll come back. Oh, you know, I should say that earlier today, Mike Pesca pointed out that we've now done an entire show about sweatpants about 2 weeks ago, and now an entire show about masks. He says, you got to do something about the torso, and so we'll work on that. But Robin Given...
the region in between.
Yes, that vast demilitarized zone there. All right, well, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to tell you a story at the end here. This story does not have anything to do with the coronavirus. It doesn't have anything to do with pandemics. It doesn't even really exactly take place in the present, although, yeah, basically it does. But it also involves ancient papyri and mummies and biblical scripture. And so get ready. Behind you. All right. It's time to say a few words of thanks here. Thanks to Kat Pastor. She is there in the studio. She is keeping us all connected, making everything work, and it also makes it possible for the rest of us to work from home. So she is one of the big heroes of Connecticut public broadcasting these days. And to Betsy Kaplan, senior producer on the Colin McEnroe Show and the producer of this particular episode on masks. Tomorrow, we actually will not be on the air because the All-American Access Aardvark Show is going to be on. That's actually not the name of it, but I can't ever remember the actual name of it. It does involve aardvarks in some way, though. And then we're going to be back on Friday. My friend David Edelstein, the critic, film critic for New York Magazine and so many other prestigious venues, and I, we're just going to have kind of a long-form conversation, and not just about movies either, but, well, anyway, we'll show you, we'll tell you. It'll be a different kind of Friday show for us. All right, so we're going to finish this show with a fascinating story that will be impossible to compress into the amount of time that we have. It is a story, as I said, going into this segment that involves ancient papyri and the search for earliest iterations of the Gospels. It involves mummies and mummy masks. And here to tell us at least some of it is Ariel Sabar, an award-winning journalist and author. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, and Smithsonian Magazine. His latest book is Veritas, A Harvard Professor, A Con Man, and The Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Welcome to our show, and thanks for doing this.
Thanks very much for having me.
So there's a lot in this story, and I think what we're going to suggest that people do ultimately is read the piece in the June 2020 print edition. It's also there online, The Case of the Phantom Papyrus, because there's just a lot of stuff that we're not going to be able to get to. But I think we could start with this idea that there is this incredible thirst, particularly among the evangelical community, particularly among very well-moneyed sectors of the evangelical community, to find definitive or very early parchments or iterations of the Christian Gospels. And maybe you'd like to say a little bit more about that and how Hobby Lobby figures into all that.
Sure. I mean, so I think, you know, it's not a surprise that among evangelical Christians, there is this belief that the Bible is inerrant, that it's historically reliable, by which they mean essentially that the first version of the Bible, and whether one can speak of a first iteration or an original Bible is of course a question that scholars debate. But if there is a sort of first iteration of the Bible, of the New Testament, I should say, evangelicals believe that version of it basically has persisted without error into the present, so that it's still the version of the New Testament one reads if one is a believer in churches today. And I think that speaks to the belief among more conservative Christians that that the Bible is God-given and that it's sort of it's the Word of God. And so it matters a lot whether the earliest papyrus fragments containing passages from the New Testament reflect the Bible that we read in churches today.
Right.
And the way that Hobby Lobby figures into that is, Hobby Lobby is a very successful private corporation. Their arts and crafts retail stores, I think there are 900 of them now from coast to coast. I think the last time I checked, they do something like $5 billion in revenue every year. And they were founded by a family of Pentecostal Christians who have, I think, are at this point the largest individual donors to evangelical ministries in the United States. They give about half of their pre-tax earnings to evangelical ministries. And so they became interested in the Bible as a kind of historical text in a really big way back in around 2011, when 2010, when they decided that they would establish a national Bible museum. And that's sort of how my story in the June issue of The Atlantic gets underway.
Right. Well, by the way, we're going to post a link to that story on the show page for this episode, too, to make it easy for people to get it. But so, I mean, then the problem becomes, you've got a museum, you get the Bible Museum, you need artifacts for the Bible Museum. And artifacts don't grow on trees. Nag Hammadi does not happen every day. A lot of the stuff that is out there is already part of major and important distinguished collections that would be unlikely to part with it to just get it into the hands of the Hobby Lobby family so they can put it in their Bible museum. So you got to find somebody who's going to provide this stuff to you. And there's two people in particular who emerge in your article as people to whom the Greens and with their big project, their Bible museum project, turn sort of saying, yeah, can you get me anything? Can you get me some of this really old stuff that we're looking for? Who are those people?
Well, so there are two people that that they bring on fairly early to sort of help them acquire and essentially become the largest private collectors of biblical artifacts in the world. So we have, you know, Steve Green is the president of Hobby Lobby. He founds the Bible Museum. And in the course of about 4 or 5 years, he amasses some 40,000 artifacts, and he needs help to do that. And one of the people he turns to is a guy named Scott Carroll, who is he has a PhD in ancient history. He fashions himself this man who is able to travel to the farthest corners of the world to sort of summon these ancient texts from little known family collections across the world in all these sort of unusual ways. And Scott Carroll has been a collector to wealthy evangelical collectors in the past. So the Greens are not his first. And then the other person they turn to is a world-renowned Oxford classicist named Dirk Obink. And Dirk Obink is probably, you know, one of the number two people in the field of papyrology. And this is the sort of specialty that studies this ancient writing material known as papyrus, which was the writing material that predominates at the dawn of Christianity. And Dirk Obink is really at the top of his game. He's a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner. He is sought out by universities and cultural institutions around the world because he has this incredible eye for piecing together the way in which these small fragments of papyrus fit together and in sort of decoding their often cryptic text. In this case, his expertise is Greek, is the ancient language of Greek.
So, and we're going to have to skip past some of this stuff just to explain to people what this conversation is doing on a show, an episode about masks. So, but I mean, it is worth noting that, as I was saying before, this kind of thing just doesn't pop out all that much. And so maybe you would need a way of finding serendipitously or appearing to find serendipitously early iterations of gospel texts. And one of the ways turns out to be this process of decomposing mummy masks. Mummy masks, in other words, the face that you see on certain mummies, the thing that's placed over the head is usually kind of an idealized image of the dead as a resurrected being. It's kind of aspirational in that sense and usually made of something called cartonnage. So, and it's this cartonnage, right, that where this idea of, oh, wow, maybe we're going to find really incredible ancient literary artifacts in the cartonnage. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so this becomes the sort of the method that Scott Carroll and in some ways Dirk Obink turned to, at least in public venues, to demonstrate how suddenly Hobby Lobby is and its representatives are coming into, you know, what is really kind of a gusher of new New Testament manuscripts at a time, you know, as you sort of pointed out, in history when sort of the great age of exploration and papyrus discoveries is about 100 years behind us. So the mummy mask, what happens in these mummy mask demonstrations is that oftentimes Scott Carroll and sometimes Dirk Obink would take these mummy masks, plunge them into a sink full of water in which, with palm olive soap, sort of massage it around underwater. And it's a really, if you've seen videos of it, it's really creepy sort of to watch because you see the kind of the mask kind of start to relax underwater and just go sort of slack. And then, you know, after sort of moving their hands around underneath the mummy masks, they are pulling out or claiming to pull out these ancient pieces either of the New Testament or in some cases of really rare Greek poetry, like in the case of some fragments of poems by the famous 6th century BC poet Sappho.
So there are a bunch of reasons to feel that this process is iffy. I mean, one of them is there's some other artifact-related questions and conservatorial-related questions about whether you should be taking 2,000 or 2,000-plus-year-old Egyptian artifacts and dumping them into sinks with palm olive just so you can maybe whip out, you know, somebody's shopping list from the Nile. And there are also questions about whether or not it really makes any sense that, you know, portions of the Gospel of Mark are likely to turn up in an Egyptian mummy mask. And one of the things that it turns out, I mean, there's a little bit of Amazing Kreskin stuff going on here, right? Sometimes that little piece of parchment wasn't in the mask at all. It was sort of there by the sink being slipped in.
Right. So, and what I discovered in the course of my reporting is that there were suspicions at some of these demonstrations about whether the amazing pieces of New Testament papyri and amazing pieces of classical literature that were being extracted from these masks and these demonstrations actually were in the masks to begin with, or whether these demonstrations were in fact a way, as many scholars now suspect, and as at least one source conceded to me, were a way in which representatives of the Green Collection were essentially quite literally, and not just figuratively, but literally laundering the provenance of papyri that came from sources that they'd rather not disclose. So it's much easier to have this sort of hocus pocus where in which a tiny piece of the New Testament appears to have been pulled out of an ancient mummy mask than to have to explain to people where you acquired this heretofore unseen piece of the gospel. And it turns out even historically, the idea is implausible, because while the Egyptians used papyri to make parts of the mummy mask for many, many years, that practice is thought to have ceased before the Christian era. So historically, we don't have any evidence, aside from the few examples in Hobby Lobby's case, that have now proven to have been something of a hoax, of these New Testament fragments being extracted from the insides of ancient mummy masks.
And just to underscore, I mean, there's a certain irony in all that, too, because for evangelical Christians, the notion that the gospel writers were chronologically a little bit distant, a little bit later than the life of Jesus himself, the notion that none of the gospel writers would really have any firsthand experiences of the kinds of things that are in the gospels is a source of some sensitivity. It's an idea they don't like that much for all the reasons you laid out at the beginning of our conversation. And the fact that in a very similar way, these mummy masks are chronologically, you know, it's the wrong time for anything that would have been part of the Gospels to appear. It almost kind of, you know, it does kind of underscore the thing they were most worried about.
Well, you know, I think, you know, in the defense, Hobby Lobby's president has said, you know, that he was naive when he began collecting. He had a lot of money to spend, but he trusted the wrong people. And, you know, this is, you know, and they have sort of, there has been this sort of public mea culpa in recent months. You know, some scholars are skeptical. They don't sort of want to let them off as easy as all of that, because, you know, they did bring in experts early on who warned them that, you know, you can't just take what some dealer tells you as the truth, that you have to investigate provenance. You have to ask hard questions of dealers who want to bring you the very thing that you've always wanted to be true. And I think that's, you know, that's something that I talk about a bit in my new book, Veritas, which is about a different case of a seemingly religious papyrus. But when someone comes to you with the one manuscript that you as a scholar or you as an evangelical Christian have always wanted to be true, and it sort of obliges one to be particularly cautious and ask a lot of really hard questions, even though in your gut you don't want to.
Right. And not to be over-peddling irony here, too, there's a way in which, you know, money is a very corrupting influence on this whole process. The fact that suddenly there's a lot of money available for this means that some of the players in this story, I mean, this guy Obink, he's a MacArthur Grant winner. He's a guy who pretty much could have written his own ticket in the field of scholarship. And here he is doing this stuff that he probably never would have guessed that he would have done. But money kind of drives all that. also, you know, in Matthew 61, where your treasure is, there also is your heart. Jesus could have told you not to do stuff like this. Don't get all the money involved. And thanks so much to you for this. First of all, terrific article, and for appearing on our show. We have to unfortunately wrap up right now. I really encourage people to read the entire article. Ariel Sabar, thank you so much for being with us today. Thanks to the rest of you for listening. Kat, take us out. And so is love. So is love.